Saddle up, listeners. We've got a wild ride ahead of us. I'm Shauna T, and today I'm inviting you to join me on a journey into the world of the working horse. In this limited podcast series, we'll be exploring together the many ways in which horses are assisting humans in work that is essential to our way of life, and how with their honesty, loyalty, and willingness to share their hearts with us, horses are helping us to become better humans. Welcome to the Hero Beside Me, the Horse Edition. Like our amazing canine friends, horses hold a host of important positions in our society. For one thing, they help to keep us fed. Horses assist cattle ranchers and some farmers as they work to keep our supermarkets stocked. Cattle rancher Renee Strickland invited me to her ranch. And while we went for a gentle horseback ride, she explained to me what the job of a horse on a cattle ranch is all about.
All right, give her a little kick, squeeze, she'll follow me. Horses are like monkey see, monkey do. You know, all the trail rides you've been on previously?
Yeah.
They like to just go into neutral mentally and follow the horse in front of them.
Autopilot, huh?
Autopilot, but there's horses that like and have to be the lead horse. There's always one in the bunch. It's like people. You always got that one person that's, come on, everybody, you know. And the horses are the same way. I've got one or two in my barn that just have to be in front. And they're great. You know, I take people trail riding and they're really good lead horses for trail riding. And then you've got horses like Ruby that are quite happy to follow, much like people.
So what's your history with horses?
My dad managed a 90,000 acre cattle ranch down in Punta Gorda called Babcock Florida Company. And my mom and dad moved to Punta Gorda when I was born, and he started managing it in 1962. I was born in 63, and he managed it for 27 years. So I grew up on a cattle ranch. We lived in town, but I got to go out to the ranch all the time with my dad. So from the time I was about seven, I had my own horses, and I've always had my own horses since then. And I'm 58 now. So there's been very little time for me out of the saddle since I was 7 years old. There was about a 2 or 3 year hiatus out of the saddle during college. And that's it. So I learned to ride working cows at the ranch. This is where you might need to, there you go. Shauna, lean forward when she comes up here. Just lean forward. Okay. Got it?
Got it. What is a day in the life of a cattle horse like?
Okay, so most of these cowboys start work on the clock at 7 a.m., but they got to get into the barn and feed their horses much sooner than that. And a lot of our cowboys don't live right on the ranch. They're what we call day working cowboys. They travel around to other ranches. And so a lot of these guys will be up at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. They'll go out, they'll feed their horses, you know, by 5:30. They might have to leave their house, put their horse on a trailer and drive to a ranch and leave by 6 o'clock, something 6 or 6:30 to get to the ranch where they're actually going to work that day. And usually by 7 to 7:30, you have a group of cowboys that are already saddled up and they're ready to go move cattle. They might be moving them from one pasture to another. They might be moving them to a set of cow pens to actually work in the cow pens. And a lot of our cowboys use dogs. In this part of Florida, they use dogs. And so some of these cowboys will come with their dogs, Their dogs ride in the trailer with the horse and stay by their horse's side. They're all trained to stay with their horse. And they know their horse. You know, they don't go to somebody else's horse. They stay with their master and their horse until they're called to do what they're supposed to do, to round up cattle. And squeeze her a little more, make her walk a little faster. So gathering cattle, they might be on the far end of a pasture, and there's a strategy to gathering cattle. Everybody talks about their game plan, you know, we're gonna go hit this corner and flush them that way or whatever. And sometimes it's nice and calm at a walk, and sometimes it's Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, depending on how the cattle handle. If the cattle are what I call dog broke, I explained that to you the other day. If they have been worked with dogs, and you call your dogs out there to gather the cattle into a tight circle, and then they circle, or the dogs will circle around, that saves your horse. Without those dogs, these horses would have to run and work really, really hard, and they could just get overheated. So the dogs can save. You can have one or two less cowboys if you've got good dogs. And while you're moving the cattle to get them to their destination, wherever you're trying to put them, if a calf or a cow runs off, if you don't have good dogs, then it's up to the cowboy and his horse to go run around outside that cow and try and push her back to the herd. So sometimes gathering cattle can be quite a workout on a horse. I mean, at the end of the day, they can be, they can be lathered up and really hot by the time you get the cows to the cow pens or wherever you need to go. Well, the dogs, these cur dogs here in this part of the United States, they use them here and they use them in Texas. All along the Gulf Coast states is where the cur dog is the most popular cow dog. Out west, they tend to use the heelers and collies and different types of dogs. But along the Gulf Coast states, we all have these curs. And as I explained to you, the curs are kind of a combination of the dogs that came over with the Spanish conquistadors from Spain back in the 1500s, as well as dogs that our Native American Indians had. And all these dogs mixed. These curs work a little differently than, say, border collies or heelers. We have trained them over the years to go out into a pasture and surround the cattle in a circular motion, and they run circles. And they keep gathering the cattle into a smaller and smaller group, and they hold them up. And the idea is for the cowboys to kind of sit on the outside of this circle of cows. And when we're gathering a big pasture, a lot of times we'll get them gathered. We'll all sit on our horses for a minute. We'll call the dogs off. Dogs will come back to the side of their master's horse, usually with their tongues hanging out. And we'll let the cattle settle down. You know, if they've got calves, we want moms and babies to find each other. Let them settle down. Let them catch some air. Let them relax, because that scared them, okay? That scared them to mob them. We call it mobbing up. That's what they call it in Australia anyway. And everybody catch their breath, let the cows calm down. And then the idea is to move them at a nice, quiet pace, much like you and I are walking right now. So if you could imagine this big group of cows. It could be 50 cows. It could be 200 cows. If you got 200, you got a bunch of cowboys on the outside holding the cows against this fence. You and I are at the back pushing them. We might have a guy up ahead of them leading them. And we'll have several people on the sides here to keep them up against this fence so that we can move these cows in a controlled manner. If one jumps out, we'll say, you know, like Peach, we'll say, hick. And Peach will run off and go get the cow and bring it back. She'll either catch it by the snout, catch it by the ear, but she'll make it, as we say, hot enough that that cow says, nope, I need to go back to my herd where it's safe. So that's the idea of what the cow dog does. And the horses are there. We're just an instrument. This horse is just an instrument for you to manage these cows. And these dogs are, they're tools. Our horses are our tools and our dogs are our tools to effectively and controllably move this group of cattle from point A to point B. You know, our Florida cowboys are used to using a whip. We use the whip for the noise. Cracking the whip makes the cattle move. And if you're getting them right up into the set of cow pens, and these cows are looking at this confined space, and maybe you've got 100 head, and you're like, I don't want to go in here. You know, it's too confined. And they have a tendency to want to turn around and come back on top of you. And that's when we get our whips out and we start popping the whips, and that noise makes them go forward. And you've got dogs and horses that are used to these whips popping off of them, ropes being thrown off of them, you know, all kinds of things that not every horse is gonna enjoy. So cow horses, by the time you've got a good cow horse, you've got a bomb-proof horse. You can do about anything off of a cow horse.
On the farming front, horses have a long history of assisting farmers. Since the advent of the tractor, however, their use on farms has declined a lot, but there are some small farms that still use them today. Historian, author, and university professor Jerry Apps shared some of that history with me.
I grew up in the middle of the Depression, and in those days, everybody had horses. There were no tractors on the farms to speak of. Tractors didn't arrive really in any number until after World War II, which would have been 1945. Prior to that, let's just go back a little bit. In the early 1800s, when much of Midwestern United States was being settled, and farmers were moving from the east, from New England, and coming from Europe to live and farm. They were satisfied with and had no choice but to farm with oxen. And oxen were slow, plodding critters. They were dependable, to be sure. But if you wanted to, as I wrote in my book, if you wanted to get to church on Sunday, you left home on Saturday afternoon, so you'd get there on time. They were slow. And so by the 1830s, we began to see the introduction of draft horses. And that would be Percheron, Belgian, Clydesdale, Suffolk, and some other breeds of draft horses to be distinguished from riding in carriage horses. There had been for some while those kinds of breeds of horses available, but draft horses had been imported from Europe as I mentioned, in the 1830s and 40s, 50s, just prior to the Civil War. And we saw at that time a tremendous revolution, and that's the correct word to use, in agriculture, because the shift from oxen, which meant a tremendous amount of human effort was involved, to horses that allowed for horse-drawn equipment to replace the human effort that was required in farming. To give you a specific example, in much of the Midwest in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, and even through the Civil War of the 1860s, farmers in the Middle West, where I grew up and where I'm most familiar, grew wheat. That was the popular crop of the day. And to grow wheat without horses or any kind of other mechanization, what was required is you planted the seed by hand. You harvested it by hand. You threshed it by hand. all hand work. And now when horses were introduced, we began to see a whole new way of thinking about agriculture, because people like Cyrus McCormick, who invented the reaper, a horse-drawn machine that replaced the cradle, the scythe that the farmer used to harvest the wheat by hand. And now a threshing machine was introduced, and no longer had that the wheat need to be threshed by hand, but this huge machine, which was powered in the early days by draft horses, some as many as four or six walking in a circle with a gear-driven system that made the threshing machine warm. So that's a little bit about what the transition from oxen to horses and what it meant to agriculture. It was a fantastic change. By the Civil War time, horses were very common on the farm. And they remained common from till 1950 on a lot of farms. So we can talk about 1830 to 1950, because it's a long time, more than 100 years. So horses have been around for a very long time. Now I've been mentioning agriculture, but draft horses were also important in the urban areas. The breweries used horses all the time to haul the beer wagons around. Horses and wagons would meet the trains and haul goods to the stores in the villages and cities where the railroad was. So horses were everywhere, not just on the farms. The history of agriculture and the place for horses in that history are important for us to remember. For some, I talk about in my book I interviewed an old Norwegian farmer, and he said, he was a bachelor, the horses are my friends. And it was that kind of relationship that existed that many people had with their horses. Their horses were as important to them as their family. They were a part of the family.
Besides helping to keep us fed, horses also work hard to keep us safe. And not just us, but our land as well. Lead packer for the National Park Service at Glacier National Park, Dave Elwood, explains the role of horses in our national parks.
My name is Dave Elwood. I'm the lead packer here in Glacier National Park for the National Park Service, our packing operation for the trail crew. I've been a permanent employee with the National Park Service. It's very rugged country. They call it the crown of the continent. There's glaciers, and the Continental Divide basically comes right down the middle of Glacier Park. So it's extremely scenic, high altitude, a lot of vertical cliffs. Our herd here in Glaciers, right now we've got about 65, 45 mules and 20 horses. Our main job here in Glacier Park is trail maintenance, trail crews. We have, I'm going to say roughly 10 trail crews, and they each work in different sections of the park. And we have six pack strings with six packers, and we haul those crews in and out of the mountains. Say they're in for a 10-day hitch. So we take their camp in, drop them off with their camp and their tools, and at the end of their hitch, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 days, we'll go back in and pick them up, bring their tools out and their camps. We patrol the trails, campgrounds. We do a lot of bear encounters, say in campgrounds, when bears are coming into backcountry campgrounds, you have to ride out, check those situations out. You do a lot of biology work. We pack a lot of equipment for biologists. Fisheries departments, we do a lot of packing for them in the mountain lakes where they're doing their research. And archaeologists and geologists, we pack a lot of geology crews. My alarm goes off at 4 o'clock in the morning. Normally, at the barn by 5:45. We bring the horses in. We have a 40-acre pasture. Our stock is, they're very, very used to the routine. Majority of the time, we can just call them, and they come up into the corrals. By, say, 6:15, we have all the horses in the corrals, and then we bring them to the grain. The feed bunks, where we tie up, feed them grain and saddle. By 6:30, 7 o'clock, everything is saddled, and depending on where the crew is going out or coming in, we load our big trucks and we haul to the trailhead, unload, and we put in, I don't think it's uncommon to put in a 20-mile day on horseback and be back to the barn by 3:30 and unsaddle, feed. We try to be finished up by 4:30 in the afternoon. I work now in Glacier. I worked in Yellowstone. I've worked at Bighorn Canyon and Mount Rushmore. It's an extremely exciting job. Can be dangerous. I used to ride a black thoroughbred horse down in Yellowstone. We'd round up buffalo. We were on the buffalo crew. It was a big black thoroughbred named Ace, and he was pretty high strung. A lot of people didn't ride him, but me and another guy from Department of Livestock were assigned to herd. There were 18 mature bull buffaloes about 7-8 miles outside of Yellowstone Park, and we were assigned to herd them back to the park, and the buffalo took off running at full speed, and we ran that 7 miles at full speed all the way back to the park. And this horse, Ace, stayed right with the buffalo. We were able to keep all the buffalo together, and it was quite a ride. It's pretty thrilling. It's a great life.
The U.S. Forestry Service uses horses in a similar way, as retired forest ranger John Nelson tells us.
Yeah, I went to Northern Arizona University, and I worked seasonally with the U.S. Forest Service then. And then when I graduated, I started permanent with the Forest Service in 1973 and worked until I retired in 2008. And most of the time there, I was working, among other things, worked with horses. Over the years, used horses for patrolling and packing supplies and equipment into trail crews that were working on trails in the backcountry, places you can't get to with a motor vehicle. You can get to with a helicopter, but helicopters are so expensive that it just made more sense to use horses for that work. And we'd pack supplies up to fire lookouts up on the top of mountains and things like that. We found it to be a really good tool. And it's kind of an interesting thing that over time, the agency started realizing that there were just some places where horses and mules made a lot of sense. And included in the things that I talked about before, but also for fire suppression, there's times when helicopters can't fly, and plus they're very expensive. And so we use horses and mules a fair amount on fires. If you Google fire suppression using horses and mules, you'll hit all kinds of pack strings from around the country who are used on fires, and it's kind of neat. But in particular, around here and across the West, where you can't get an ATV into some of the backcountry, and some of the places that are designated wilderness areas, which is a special designation, no motorized vehicles, that kind of thing. And there's huge chunks of land where you can't take an ATV. And so horses and mules are the only ticket, not the only ticket, but the best ticket, you know, for doing the heavy lifting into the backcountry in places like that. Everything from tools like, you know, shovels and picks and rock bars and things like that, and water and camp equipment. I mean, everything that a crew that's working in the backcountry, whether on trails or on fire or whatever, would need, you know, to stay in the backcountry for a week or longer. Today, the Forest Service is using hired crews, non-Forest Service hired crews, like Southwest Conservation Corps. That's an organization here in our area. And they're using crews like that to do more trail work in the backcountry. And if we use horses and mules to haul all their equipment up, they don't have to make multiple trips back and forth to the trailhead to haul their gear. Plus, they're in better condition when they get in 10 or 15 miles into the backcountry. And so they're more productive that way. And that's, you know, a real advantage, I think, to using them. And more, we're doing that kind of work.
Thanks in part to the work of horses, we in the United States have a lot of public and government-owned lands and open spaces to enjoy. Hiking, backpacking, camping, hunting, fishing, and exploring these lands is a meaningful pastime and lifestyle for many people. But what happens when someone becomes lost or injured while out in the backcountry? Again, our equine friends are ready and willing to come to our aid.
Horses are used in search and rescue. They have a visual advantage. The rider is up so high that they can see a vast area. So the rider is looking for evidence. The horse already has a sixth sense. They already know if there's something in the field. They have that innate ability.
That was Maria Colina, search specialist of Peace River Canine Search and Rescue in Southwest Florida. She and I were having this conversation at Mayaca State Forest, where the mounted unit of Peace River was gathered to do training exercises. You might hear some birds chirping in the background.
Search and rescue, usually the police will go out first, and they'll do hot tracks and things like that. When they exhaust their resources, they usually call us in. Peace River Search and Rescue has been all over the United States and also in the Bahamas. We are looking for people that are lost, missing, or expired, depending on the circumstance. Sometimes we don't get called out 2, 3, 4 weeks later, which means, especially in Florida, with these conditions and environment, the person is more than likely expired. We may search for days in a row, or it may be something simple like, okay, the police want you to go to this field, or they have several fields they want you to search. We don't always find somebody, but if we search a field, we can tell you whether or not. And we use the dogs and the horses to help us. The horses, they are easy to train. At first, I was skeptical on training them for cadaver because they don't like being around things that are expired, that smell like that. But believe it or not, the horses took to it so quickly, it just amazed me. And area search is where they go out and just look for someone alive. They do that very easily. We have grid lines with people. We have grid lines with the horses. And we go out and we search for the people. We look for clothing. We look for evidence, telephones, purses, any kind of clothing, jackets, shoes, anything. And if we do find something, we stop. We call it in, we mark our points. If we find a person, if a person is down and still alive, we are a rescue group as well. We will perform CPR. We will perform any first aid that we are qualified to do. We call it in immediately. Someone comes out with the 4x4, the side by side, or an ambulance, if possible, to package the person and take them out.
As Marie mentioned, search and rescue teams assist law enforcement in providing additional resources when people are lost. But horses work directly for law enforcement agencies as well, as police horses. Former Mounted Patrol Officer and horse trainer, Patty Reed, welcomed me to her farm in Southwest Florida, where some of the St. Petersburg police horses live, and where Patty trains both the human and horse officers. On this particular day, Two police officers who are new to the mounted unit are training with the horses in Patty's training ring as I join the party with my microphone and field recorder.
And then just remember, you're going to be looking up because we're in the ring now, but normally we're going to be on the street with cars. So, and then don't cross over. Remember, that's that left and right there. There you go. And then just steer him right back up over to the rail for a second. We always do our, I call it the yoga warm-up. They need about 15 minutes. Give them, ideally would be a 30 to 45 minute warm-up. But kick him on and just ask him to go over to the rail. So close your left door. Hi, I'm Patty Gail Reed. A lot of people just call me Patty Gail, but I am a mounted unit instructor. I'm a level 3 ARI mounted unit certification holder, and I do agencies worldwide. The main thing for police horses are they're great PR. That is the main job of the police horses, that you're more likely to have a great interaction with people off of that police horse than you are anything else. More people will walk up to that horse than they're gonna walk up to a cruiser. They're gonna walk up and interact with you, they're gonna interact with the officer, and it just opens the door for just good communication. Then other thing that they can use it for is when they're doing, like if they're in the malls and they're looking, for, you know, if you got shoplifters or something, they can see over the top of all the cars. And if you're in a car, you can't see over the car. If you're on a bicycle, I mean, the difference between them and a bicycle is night and day. They can see anything. They can also maneuver. If, you know, if you're in a cruiser, you're on a motorcycle and you're on a bicycle, you can't cut through half of the neighborhood alleyways, the parking lots between cars with those horses. You're gonna go straight line as best you can. So that helps get an officer on scene a lot faster. If you've got a crowd of people and they need to get into an area and they just need to see what's going on, they can walk in between. 99% of the time, people are very receptive to the animals and they're gonna go through there. So, you know, a big part of their stuff is just being able to see what's going on, assist the other officers, assist the ground officers, fire department, and assist doing that way. You know, if they need to help with any situations that happen, you know, if we've got something that's going on and they just need to make a line just to form a barrier, they can do that. And they're just going to stand there, you know. So that's the idea behind them.
How do you desensitize them to crowds?
We work them into it. We do a lot of training here. That's what we do with this. As long as you can teach the horse not to bolt and to stand, then you're okay. You got to just teach them that they learn to trust you, that you're like, we're just going to stay right here. We're not going to do anything. Then, and they want to be with people. So to them, it's just a crowd of people being silly. They go, well, let's go be with the people. So it's not, they don't look at people as a bad thing, and they don't look at people as a crowd that doesn't like them. They look at them as a crowd of people that they like. And then we cue them to do a job, and they do their job. They don't know the difference. We train the horses to interact with every vehicle, person, and animal that they may encounter. We do a lot of that. We even train for pigs and goats. Chickens, pigs, goats, we train for any of it, because you just never know. I mean, you really, you know, especially Pinellas Park is such an agriculture city. There's all kinds of farms and animals here. So, you know, there's nothing saying that you're not going to go to a call that involves some kind of, and we do a lot of search and rescue, for hurricanes and so forth. So you will encounter things you've never seen before when you do it. And we prepare them for that. And we go in buildings, because you never know if you have to go in a building. We go, you know, up to cars, trains, whatever we can find, that's what they do. So we put the horses, we recreate, we even bring helicopters in for training. We bring in whatever we need to, sirens, fire trucks, recreate scenarios, and we train downtown in the streets. So I can train them all day in a ring, but when you change, it's amazing. If you take and you just move your scenarios to an area they've never been, now you've got a whole different area that they got to get used to. Plus you've got all this, so you got to take those few moments to be like, I've never walked across a bridge with water underneath it. Well, now today you are.
Later that week, I joined Patty and the officers again for an evening training in town.
So what are they doing tonight?
We are doing street training because we can't recreate this at a barn. My style of training is just once a horse, we'll stand like we were at the buses. I don't know if you saw us. We'll just stand at a bus for an hour at a bus stop and just let them see the buses go, see the buses come, see the buses go. They make noise, they raise, they lower, people get on and off, all the things you can't recreate anywhere. Noticing that when we do this is we're always looking for things that we can train on that we may need on the street later. So if there was a crowd of people up here, people couldn't get out, we needed to move them, then we're going up. If you have an active shooter, you have something going on that you have to maneuver stairs, we train for stairs. People never think about that. Horses don't look at them like, oh, they're just stairs. They train on them. So we're letting them, they've got ramps on either side. So they're gonna go up the stairs. Go upstairs, down the ramp, and then we'll turn around. We might even go down these stairs. There you go, kick him right on up. Down the ramp or the stairs, either one.
One of the horses does not seem too keen on the on the stairs.
Jay, go right ahead, Jake, go. There you go, now follow. Now go a little bit that way, Brittany, and you move a little bit that way and then let her come up. There you go.
The horse, who's hesitant about the stairs, saw his friends go up the stairs and eventually followed. If you've never watched a horse go up or down stairs before, you'd be surprised.
You know, you see the real purpose of them in that area because it can be anything from helping somebody to moving a crowd. I've had people when I was on the street, I've had people that I've arrested and the next, you know, they see me at the movie theater, just standing by the door and they come up and they talk to me and they pet the horse. So I, you know, and they're like, hey, you know, hey officer, you know, they're saying my name and they just turn around and they're like, I'm like, you doing all right? They're like, I'm trying. I mean, you become a very easy person to talk to. And I think that's, it's really cool to watch some of the people that, you know, you interacted with a lot when you're in your cruiser and that, and then when they see you on the horse, how they give you the nod, they give you the what's up. Kids just, even your hardest kids will come up when you're like, hey, you know, they may be cool, but they're still gonna come over and give you that nod, or their girlfriend's gonna come over, or their boyfriend's gonna come over. So it makes it, that's rewarding to see that they still kind of like, you get that human interaction. And you get, you know, a lot of times, you know, a lot of people, they may be a little intimidated by him, but to watch some of the people of all ages touch a horse for the first time, because think about it, when are they in the middle of a city gonna get to really touch a horse? So they get to come to the movie theaters, let's say, you know, I was at the movie theaters every Friday and Saturday night. They would come just to see the horses. And, you know, you take them to nursing homes and those people's faces just light up. You take them to schools and the kids, that's gonna be their topic of conversation for a month. I got to see the horse. I got to see the horse do this. The horse did that. To me, it's just an invaluable way to communicate with them.
Keeping our streets safe is essential to the job of a horse in law enforcement. But horses help to keep our borders safe as well. Border Patrol uses horses on their force, as does the military. Horses have an impressive resume in the warfare department. They've been charging into battle with their soldiers since biblical times. And besides being used in cavalries, horses were used in the military for recon missions, to carry supplies, and for general transportation. But even though we now use modern technology to do many things in our military that horses were previously required for, horses still play an important role in today's military. Colonel Clint George, a U.S. Army veterinarian, tells us more.
Yes, in the military horses do exist throughout DoD, and there are many ways that they can be used to accomplish many types of missions. There's probably three main categories, and the biggest one that they're used for is ceremonial, whether they're used for funeral detail, you know, like out at Fort Meade, they have a huge set of horses that is used for change of commands for a lot of the higher brass elements. And that's one ceremony, it'd be like a change of command. And at Fort Sam Houston and Hood, they have elements of these horses that come out and perform during change of commands. And then there's the other one where it's funeral detail, where they will go out and be the pallbearers of the casket in a wagon of sorts as they're taken to their graveside. And then the other portion is that these ceremonial horses do is they do a lot of parades. You know, these first cab horses might get ended up in a parade, or the Mounted Marine Corps Color Guard might represent the Marine Corps by sending their horses to some of these big parades. So ceremonial is probably the biggest portion that horses do for us. And then another category would be mental health. There's a morale, welfare, and recreation that most installations have, where they have a small set of horses kept in stalls that people, soldiers, active duty, airmen, Marine Corps, Marines could go and ride those horses if they wanted to for their own recreational mental health well-being. And then the other aspect would be the mental health, the wounded warrior, the you know, those guys that are struggling, and horses provide a neat companionship, understanding, and they're just a great resource for that soldier that needs that mental well-being. And when I say soldier, I'm talking airmen and Marines and Navy as well, so sailors as well. Then the next one is operational use of horses within the military. They do patrol borders. They patrol bases. The Marines have a PAC course up in the mountains where they teach not only the Marines, but all military forces to use as pack animals. And then the special operations community sometimes sends their guys to that Marine course, but sometimes they have their own courses that they offer internally that teaches their guys to do the specific thing they need them to do, whether it be actually horsemanship skills of riding or how to use a horse for pack animals. And these missions are then followed out and utilized globally, whether it be in the Middle East, Asia, South America. They are actually, some missions are being run even today using horses in various ways. They're not usually used as assault animals, but they're more used for transportation and pack animals.
While it's true that these days horses in the United States military are not typically used in actual warfare, our next guest has a remarkable story that's an exception to that rule.
Hi, I'm Mark Newt. I'm from a Flint Hills ranching family in Kansas. Grew up around quarter horses, showing them, competing through grade school, high school, and rodeoing in college for a couple years. That was my background, being around horses. And then I completed the Kansas State University Army ROTC program, got a commission as an infantry officer, went into active duty, and then end up serving in the special operations community in the 3rd Ranger Battalion, and then wanted to stay in the special operations and ended up in 5th Special Forces Group as a detachment commander in charge of one of the A teams known as Operational Detachment Alpha 595. And our team became known as the Horse Soldiers because of our unique mission right after 9/11, spearheading America's response into Afghanistan, where we uniquely rode horseback for 24 days in the mountains of north central Afghanistan, uniting different ethnic tribes, bringing them together, raising up a militia army that was all on horseback, helping to arm and equip them and coordinate their activities, gather intelligence, coordinate airstrikes and aerial resupply drops. And because of the terrain, the main mode of getting around was by horseback. And it wasn't until about 24 to 48 hours prior to our insertion that our counterpart CIA team informed us that we need to be prepared to ride horseback, as they had experienced as soon as they got in to Afghanistan. And so the training was the very first morning in country in Afghanistan, when 6 of us had to quickly mount horses for the first time and conduct a movement on horseback that ended up being about 4.5 hours. Given, you know, riding lessons right there to the guys, you know, how do you control the animal that's not very well trained? How do you carry your rifle? What gear do you leave on your back? What can you leave behind? Just developing our standard operating procedures right there, literally at the trot and at the gallop. Because of that ranching and rodeo background, I had the most deepest, extensive horse riding experience. I had one of my younger sergeants from South Dakota had grown up a little bit riding horses for the other 10 guys on our team. They were not prepared. They had not received that in their, you know, growing up. These guys did an amazing job learning how to ride horseback in combat for the very first time. Again, with my background, had studied some different Civil War, you know, part of our military reading growing up was, you know, learning lessons from different battlefields. And because of my background with horses, I gravitated towards reading about various Civil War commanders, both on in the Union and in the Confederacy, and just more about their operations. And I, you know, had walked different Civil War battlefields to better understand some of those aspects. Also, out in Fort Riley, Kansas, near where I grew up, is the U.S. Cavalry Museum that tells the story of the frontier cavalrymen and the American West opening up. So I had seen some of those displays, read some of those books and things about those campaigns on horseback. So fortunately, I was able to recall some of those things. And so we started to develop the tactics and, you know, what do you carry? What can I leave behind? And just how to work from the horses, to include using them as pack animals. It felt like you're stepping back in time in some aspects, you know, because you basically have an 18th century force on horseback, and there's hundreds of them. You know, we had about 300 militia fighters all on horseback that first day. They had tactics. They had an advanced party. They had flanking units, and then the main body as you were moving across that terrain. And, you know, to prevent surprise or ambush from the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, the horses gave us the mobility in the terrain where the Taliban and Al-Qaeda had all the modern mechanized, motorized, armored personnel carriers, and the horses gave us the ability to get, you know, all terrain, all weather, day or night, get in around them, behind them, amongst them. You know, when the Taliban or Al-Qaeda with those vehicles were actually tied to roads and fuel depots, you know, they got to get fuel somewhere. We would ride day and night in the snow, crossing streams, getting rained on. It was like I said, stepping back in time to a Western movie that I'd watched growing up, you know, only it's real. This is happening. We got to know, you know, these different horses. It was, think of it as horse roulette each day. You may be riding a different horse for a period of time, but with all that change, we needed to have some consistency. And we were finally able to get the same group of animals, horses that we would ride each day. And for me personally, I ended up with a buckskin stallion that was my personal horse that I rode the majority of the time. And after we no longer needed the horses, my teammates and I, we'd go to where the horses were stabled, you know, in an evening or something, or in the morning or something, and just go check on them because of that emotional bond that had been created. I was fortunate. I got to go. I went back to Afghanistan several times. So I was fortunate. I was able to go back and visit this buckskin stallion several times over the years, and even got to ride him again to play the traditional game of buscacci. We ended up keeping the horses close to us, even though we didn't need them for combat necessarily anymore. A couple of the guys would still continue to ride the horses around the neighborhood or city, if you will, more for recreational purposes, but also for just, you know, to have that presence again and be able to cover ground between some rural communities. In that terrain, in that culture, in that environment, horses were definitely an added advantage. There was only been a few instances of special operations units riding horses temporarily in the conduct of some of these missions, even over the last 20 years, but no one had done it to the scope and scale of hundreds of horses or 24 days of constant, you know, combat operations with the horses, you know, in a austere mountain setting, you know, where you're living off the land and moving over that terrain. There have been several books written about our team because of the, you know, the historic aspect, spearheading America's response after the attacks of 9/11, and just uniquely, you know, that our team uniquely rode horseback in combat, something that hadn't been done for you know, since World War II. One of them became the movie 12 Strong, and it portrays the core aspects of our team's mission, working with the different Afghan militia forces on horseback. Some of the scenes are very accurate. Some of them didn't necessarily happen to our team, but they happened to other special forces teams. So that's part of the Hollywood movie magic. Overall, I think they made a great film, but there, again, there's so much more to the story. You know, for the guys that lived it, that experience, you could have done a 6 to 8 hour miniseries on that experience. It was just, it was so incredible every day to see it. The first time our team was brought together with some of the other special operations veterans, did a special screening at Fort Bragg. And to have our, you know, sit in audience and with our wives and family and see that portrayed for the first time, it was definitely emotional to see it. And it was a proud moment as well.
As Mark mentioned, the story of his unit was made into a movie called 12 Strong, which was released in 2018, which brings us to yet another important job for horses in today's world, the job of the movie horse. Join us in part two of this special horse edition of The Hero Beside Me as we talk about horses in the entertainment industry, as well as equine sports, horses who work in tourism, and last but certainly not least, we'll talk about therapy horses and the work they're doing to help us maintain our mental health. Thank you for listening. I can't wait to see you next time.